This is a Dharmanet presentation.
So for this evening's Dhamma talk, I'd like to go into more detail in talking about some of the topics that I mentioned briefly, talking before the meditation, and particularly on the conditionality and the way that the mind is formed and the way the mind works. This is something which is very central to Buddhist teachings, and it's, I think, one of the unique qualities of the Buddha Dhamma is that the Buddha gave such a central importance towards understanding the mind and understanding how the mind works. Essentially, the goal of Buddhism, to find freedom, to find peace, to find happiness, comes when you can really understand how your mind works and that you're able to let go of it. Of course, this is not just an understanding on an intellectual level, but understanding at a very deep experiential level and understanding at a level of letting go. So according to Buddhism, there's a number of different kinds of understanding, but the most important one is the understanding that lets go. It's able to let go of suffering, let go of attachment. So when we're listening to Dhamma, thinking about Dhamma, reading Dhamma, reflecting on it, discussing it, and so on, this is like sowing the ground or preparing the way for those deeper realizations and deeper letting go. It's a very curious thing because there's nothing closer to us than our mind. I mean, it's so close we can't see it. It's so close, it's not just in everything that we've ever done and ever known. It is everything we've ever done, we've ever known. Every thought we've had, every memory, every emotion, everything we've seen, every song we've heard. This is your mind. So, of course, Buddhism is not an idealist philosophy. It doesn't say that there's only mind and nothing else. Okay? But the point is that what we can see and what we can know is what we're knowing with our mind. And it's a curious thing that we give so much care and attention and so much interest to knowing things outside of our mind and very little to knowing actually what our mind is. I think one of the reasons for that is because it is so elusive. It's very hard to pin down. If we look at the state of things in Western psychology and Western science and so on, then, well, it's not all that impressive, is it? So I don't mean to be insulting to any psychologists that happen to be in the room. But, I mean, if you look at the what we can do and where our state of knowledge and what we can do with psychology compared with, say, the advances in physics or engineering or chemistry or something like that, you know, where there's, you know, obviously there's an incredible increase in our knowledge. But in terms of psychology, well, we've probably learned a few things from psychology, but there's still a lot of things we don't know, and there's still a lot of things we don't know about the brain. And I've over recent months, I've become more and more skeptical about neuroscience. I'm now officially a neuroscience atheist. I don't believe in neuroscience anymore. Why not? Why not? Why don't I believe in neuroscience anymore? because of golf. Yeah. Well, golf is important there too, because how do the balls go up if they're under the influence of gravity? Anyway, so that should be clear. So, well, no. Is okay. You think about it, right? Now you think of what when this is a bit of a kind of a side thing, but. Okay, what are you doing? Let's say you're doing an MRI scan, right? So what does an MRI scan do? MRI, magnetic resonance imagery. And so it measures or it reads in a kind of 3D map something about magnetic resonance, what's happening in your brain. Now, the resolution that they can do that in is quite low. I think there's one pixel per about 70,000 neurons or something like that. Okay, so the degree of resolution that they're able to pick up is very kind of small, but very, very coarse. And you can sort of make these kind of maps of what's going on in the brain. So you measure magnetic resonance and you assume that, well, if you're picking up magnetism, it's because there's iron there. And you assume that if there's iron there, then there must be blood there, right? And if you assume that if there must be blood there, then there must be some kind of brain activity. Your brain needs the blood. That's why the blood is there. So you assume that that's got some kind of relationship to what your brain is doing, and you assume that that's then got some kind of relationship with what your mind is doing. And there's a lot of fairly tenuous kind of series of links there. And so, you know, I think it's always very, very wise to be very cautious about that. But then I became even more skeptical about it when I started thinking about golf. Imagine that you did an MRI scan of somebody who's playing golf. Right? So instead of doing just their brain, you did the whole body. Yeah? And you did the same thing. You picked up where does the blood go when they're playing golf. Right? And so presumably what you'd pick up would be, you'd say, well, you know, when they're preparing for the swing, it's just like standing. It would probably not that different to kind of an ordinary person standing. But then when they actually take the shot, you know, there's probably a lot of blood flow to the upper body, shoulders and arms and so on. And so you'd read that and you'd conclude, well, golf is all about upper body strength, because that's what we can measure with our fMRI scan. Yeah? But of course, if you talk to a golfer will tell you it's got nothing to do with upper body strength. Yeah? Golf is about balance. Yeah? Playing golf is about poise. It's about knowing when's that moment to actually hit the ball. It's about having your eye that can see where it's going to go. And none of those things are going to be even vaguely picked up by the MRI scan. And it's not even, I can't even see how they possibly could be. And if something which is so relatively coarse as golf, and again, apologies to any golfers who may be present, I hope I don't misrepresent your sport in saying this, if something as relatively coarse as golf is still so out of reach and still is so poorly represented by something like an fMRI scan, how much more so is something subtle like wisdom or compassion? Yeah? I mean, what do you actually... You know, people say you can do the fMRI scans and you can see when these things are happening in people's brains. I mean, what are you actually seeing? I mean, for all we know, the compassion is happening actually in two neurons in the back of the head that have nothing to do with what's going on with all the stuff you can measure in the fMRI. But then you can say, well, you can test it because if someone has damage in that region, then they can't feel compassion. Yeah? So that's one way you can test it. But it's the same thing applies to the golfer, doesn't it? They can injure their shoulder. Well, they can't play golf anymore. So it's got something to do with it, but actually it's not the important thing. So this is why I suspect that what we're seeing in a lot of these things, yeah, it has something to do with these kinds of emotions, it has something to do with mental activity, but I'm not at all convinced that we really know what it is that it has to do or how those things work. So anyway, I'll just kind of throw that out there, and those of you who are true believers can refute me later on. Moving on to what I was saying, the basic point I was trying to make with all that was simply that in the West and through our scientific methodology, we haven't really advanced all that far in our understanding of how the mind works, I think. And I'm not convinced that, that science is going to be all that helpful in that regard. So if we take a step back from that and have a look at how the Buddha approached things, of course the Buddha approached things from a very different perspective, and he approached things from the subjective. He said, well, it's not about looking at the mind in or the brain in a laboratory or with machines or something like that. It's about investigating and reflecting on experience, how you actually know. And in this, the Buddha was very radical and very subversive in that religious culture at the time. If you look at how most religions work, they work by one of the things that they try to do is they try to bring your mind out of the mundane and into some kind of transcendent world. So they raise your thought up to the thought of the gods or the thought of the divinity or something like that. So it's kind of they raise people up by raising their attention to something which is felt to be better or higher or is going to lift you out of your give perspective to the sufferings of your life. And so rather than doing that, the Buddha took a very different approach and said, no, don't put your attention anywhere else. The practice of meditation is not about reflecting on divinity or transcendence or anything like that. The practice of meditation is about looking at what is happening here and now in this very body, in this very mind. Looking at things that are very, very ordinary. Yeah? And this is a very, very subversive and disturbing way to approach religious life. And one of the things that's quite interesting in religious history is the reactions of some of the Europeans when they went to places like Sri Lanka and they started to read some of the sacred scriptures. And so one of the most revered texts in Sri Lanka is the Satipatthana Sutta. And very often sort of copies of it are kept in the monastery and these kinds of things. And then when the first Westerners sort of started to read these things and get people to explain, what is this sacred text? And they were like, oh yes, well you sit down and then you watch your parts of your body and there's hair of the head and hair of the body and nails and teeth and skin and flesh and bones and urine and excrement and you're supposed to reflect on these things and so on. And they're like, it was like, what? What are these people doing? Yes, and then you reflect on on the bones, yes, a corpse which is being eaten by jackals and... What's going on? Yeah, how is this religious? You know, to be bringing your mind and your attention to something which is so ordinary and so everyday. This is a you know, you shouldn't underestimate how radical and how powerful this innovation that the Buddha brought. We can find all of those things that people look for in religion, the transcendence, the freedom, the joy, the sense of a higher meaning. The sense of a greater context to live our life in. All of those things we can find not by seeking them in some transcendent idea, but through looking into ourselves, looking at understanding our own mind. So, when the Buddha analyzed consciousness, he would typically use the most common kind of analysis, chakuncha paticca rupeca upadati chaku vinyanang tenang sangati paso. So dependent on the eye and forms arises eye consciousness, and the three of them coming together is contact. So again, you sort of notice the way that the Buddha's talking about these things. He talks about it in a very, very matter-of-fact way. Yeah, he's just describing an empirical process. Yeah, and he doesn't do it in a way that's trying to persuade you that this is what's happening. He does it in a way that invites you to reflect on your own experience and to see what is actually going on in your experience. It's also, I think, interesting, and something which you wouldn't necessarily notice within the Buddhist tradition, that the Buddha is always very consistent in how he presents sense experience. Like, he always lists the senses in the same order: eye, ear, nose, the tongue, the body. And of course, the sixth sense in Buddhism is always the mind. Okay, so that's quite interesting in itself, that the mind is regarded as an organ of perception in the same way that the other senses are. Okay, obviously in some ways different, right? But in some ways similar. Now, in Buddhism, that's entirely consistent. It's always presented in that same way. If you look in the pre-Buddhist scriptures, the Upanishads and so on, they're not consistent at all. The senses are constantly presented in different sequences, or they're mixed up with other things. So instead of being just the senses, it'll be mixed up with like breath or speech or other kind of faculties and things, which sort of conceptually, we can't understand why they're in the same kind of category. So the Buddha sort of cleaned it up and rationalized it and said, okay, we have these six senses. And starting with the eye, I think, is very significant. The eye is very important as a sense, I think, for humans generally. Huh? But I think also the eye is interesting because it's more clear in terms of a separation between the basis of sight, yeah, the eye here, and the sight out there, yeah. Whereas things like smell, for example, or touch, or taste, they're much more kind of intimate. Yeah, whereas the eye, there's that kind of separation. So by beginning with sight, then we set that model of being able to understand that these are kind of distinct things, that there's a rupa, there's an external thing. And, you know, we shouldn't underestimate how precise and how accurate this is. If you look in ancient civilizations and theories of sight, you know, you see that many cultures have quite unscientific, or what today we would think of as unscientific theories of sight. For example, many people believe that you see things because your eyes send out a ray, right? So that it's not the light coming in, but actually you send out a ray, which is what enables you to see. And this is quite a common belief that many people have. And so the Buddha's ideas on this is based on that kind of direct experience. The eye and forms, rupa. And of course, these days we know that of course, this is how sight arises. Yeah, we have to have the physical basis for sight. And in a broad sense, then that's, of course, the entire eye with the lens and so on and so forth. But in the kind of the narrow sense, and you have the rods and cones at the back of the eye, which actually sort of are sensitive to light, the light-sensitive cells. And there has to be some external phenomenon that we can see, we call rupa. It stimulates the sight. And the two of those coming together, upajati chakavinyanam, visual consciousness. So one of the things that we notice here is that the Buddha treated consciousness as being different kinds of things. Okay, eye consciousness is one kind of thing, ear consciousness is another kind of thing. Again, obviously similar kinds of things, but different. This also is very important, that from a Buddhist point of view, that these things are not... It's not that it's just a thing which is consciousness. Yeah? But consciousness is a function that arises out of certain causes and conditions. Now, I think it's remarkable how different these kinds of consciousness are. And this is one of the things that we can reflect on in meditation. Yeah? And this is actually a very powerful meditation, is to go through the different senses. And if you focus on each sense as much as you can and get a very clear, you know, just what is sight like? What is it like to see? Yeah? And just focus on that, ignoring all of your other senses. And then you go and say, well, what is it like to hear? And you focus on that, focus just on hearing. Yeah? And you realize that they're completely different kinds of things. And how strange it is that we live in this world where somehow these things are just kind of united. It becomes the same thing when you meet a person and the person speaks to you and you can see that person, you can see their mouth move and you can hear them, and that's all put together in your mind, right? That this is that person who is speaking. In fact, actually what we do is we see light and we hear the sound. Two completely different kinds of things. And our mind puts them all together. The Buddha gave a wonderful simile called the chapana, the six animals. And he said that there are six senses, is like as if you have a crocodile, a jackal, a bird, a dog, a snake, and something else, I can't remember, a fish or something like that, all tied up together, right, by one post, right? And they're all kind of, and that's what it's like. And we somehow have to make sense of that world, of all of these different kinds of things. So in a meditation, we investigate that and we see, this is the arising of Chakvijnana. Dhyanang Sangatipaso is coming together of the three is contact. So we think of contact is something like stimulus. Yeah. So what it means is that all of those things have to be there together. Obviously, you have to have enough awareness, right, and to actually pay attention. And we all kind of know what that's like. Either maybe if you're asleep, or if you're very distracted, yeah, or something like that. You're walking down the road, checking your emails on your phone, and then get run over by a bus. You know, we all know what that's like. So. So you actually have to have that active attention, yeah? And so all of those things have to come together. And so this is that contact, that pasa, that stimulus. And so that idea of pasa is actually a very, very interesting idea in Buddhist psychology. The Buddha said it gave a simile for pasa, they usually translate it as contact. But the word pasa literally means touch. But it's applied to all of the senses, not just the sense of or the physical sense of touch. And so that pasa, that contact, he said, what is it like? He said, pasa is like a flayed cow. A cow with its skin ripped off. And if it's standing in the under the trees, then all the animals under the trees, little insects, are devouring its exposed nerves. And if it goes into the open, then all the animals there are eating its exposed nerves. And if it goes into the water, then the animals there are eating it as well. It's kind of revolting, isn't it? But that's what it feels like, yeah? And that's something which, when you go, the deeper and deeper you go into meditation, the more you realize that that's the case. Yeah? And that we actually go in our life seeking for stimulus, right? Our minds are hungry for experience. We want to see sights. We want to taste. We want to hear things. Yeah? And yet it's actually underneath is this kind of irritation. And what often what those distractions are doing is those things we want to see, they're actually kind of distracting us from a greater irritation. Like if we weren't able to see those things, right? You see something beautiful, so that distracts your eyes for a while. And that distracts you from all the other more painful things that you can be experiencing. It's pasa. And that comes out more and more when you're sitting in meditation, yeah? So we were just talking earlier about the incredible suffering of the clock that rings in meditation, right? Or that ticks. And you've lived your whole life and you've never once thought of a ticking clock or a clock going off as being something which is annoying or suffering or something. But when you sit in meditation, suddenly it's like, oh God, that's yeah? It's pasa, it's contact, yeah? Because you're starting to perceive what is it like to actually be peaceful. What is it like when you don't have that constant irritation of contact, yeah? And then even those little things, those very innocuous things. Yeah, a little itch on your skin or something like that. And it actually becomes very quite painful or quite annoying. So this is how in that we're seeing this conditionality of consciousness, yeah? And so the same, even though the Buddha started with teaching the eye, the same applies to all of the other senses, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body. And each of those can be investigated in the meditation in the same way. But of course, the most interesting one is the mind. And the Buddha said the mind is like, he described it in one simile as being like the lord of the city that sits in the middle of the crossroads. Yeah? Very interesting simile, yeah? And so the idea is that the lord of the city sitting in the middle at the crossroads, and from each direction, yeah, messengers come. Yeah? So and they come into the city through the gates. Of course, the gates of the city are the senses. Yeah? So the messengers are the stimulus through the six senses. So the mind is sitting at the middle of all of these senses. Yeah? The mind, the eye consciousness sees, but eye consciousness only sees color. Right? It sees light. That's all. The ear consciousness hears, but all ear consciousness hears is like the wavelengths of vibrations of air, yeah, called sound. It doesn't hear songs and voices and cars. We make that up in our heads, yeah, in our minds. The ear only hears sounds, yeah. And similarly, the nose only smells smells, the tongue only tastes flavors, the body only tastes touches. All the meaning of those things is given in the mind. So the mind does the most complex, by far the most complex job out of all of those things. But one of the wonderful things about the way that the Buddha talked about experience in this way was that he again, following a very scientific approach, in science you always start with what is clear, what is well established, and then you can gradually infer and develop towards what is less known, right? This basis of scientific method. Yeah, you start out with known facts and then you move towards what's unknown. So that's why you start out with what's more clear, is the eye and the sight and that kind of consciousness which we can analyze in experience fairly readily. And then you use that same model when we're applying it to understanding the mind. And so just as we have the inner eye and the external objects, you have the inner mind and the external objects of the mind, okay? So the inner mind is the awareness, right? The mano-vijnana, mind consciousness. And then the external objects of mind, so the external objects of mind are anything that you experience or are aware of that you're not aware of through the other five senses, okay? So that includes thoughts, emotions, yeah, it includes imagination, so it includes images and so on you conjure up in your mind, memories, and so on and so forth. So these are all the dhamma, the objects of the sixth sense, the objects of the mind. And just as in the same way that the eye consciousness depends on some light, right? You can't see anything without having light. Now, that's not just when we think about that, right? Okay, we can think of it in a fairly shallow way, saying, well, if you turn all the lights out, right, you can't see anything. Yeah, but it applies in a much deeper sense as well. If we didn't live in a world with light, we would have never have evolved eyes, right? If we were some kind of slug organism that was living in the bottom of a cave, right? And a mile under the earth or whatever, or living at the bottom of the ocean or something, where there's no light, we'd either develop some kind of phosphorescence so we could glow, or we wouldn't have eyes. Right? So that the presence of light is actually causing the eyes to exist, right? Not in an immediate sense, but if you think of it in the long-term sense, yeah, without the light, we wouldn't have eyes. And so it's the same thing with the mind. It's not just that we have an awareness that happens to be aware of thought, right? But it's thought actually conditions what the very nature of the mind is. It's not just that it happens that we are aware of a memory, but memory's conditioning the very nature of what the mind is. So there's this mutual conditioning going on all the time. And the Buddha talked about this, he said that the Pali phrase for it is that nama rupa paccaya vijnana and vijnana paccaya nama rupa. That nama rupa, which is the forms, the shapes, and the concepts in the world, condition awareness, and awareness conditions the forms, shapes, and concepts in the world. And he described it as being like two sheaves of wheat, which are tied up in bundles, and they lean against each other. Yeah? And so if you pulled one of them away, then the other one would fall down. Again, you can think about it by doing a thought experiment. Imagine what it would be like if you were a child who was born into a world where there was no stimulus for their mind. Right? Say, for example, no one speaking language. Right? What's going to happen? Obviously, the way that your mind develops and evolves is going to be very different. Imagine what it would be like if you were born in a world where no one said the word memory. Right? No one said, oh, I remember doing this yesterday. Yeah? Memory is not just something which is innate. It's not something that's given to you. It's something that you learn how to do. And when people say things like, oh, I remember doing this yesterday, you pick up on that word, you get this idea what it is, and then you start to practice it and to remember it and to pick that up as well. It's a learned behavior. Imagination is a learned behavior. These things don't just happen. Even if we look on a more advanced level, we think about meditation, right? So we like to imagine that in our meditation we can go beyond concepts. Right? We can sit there, let the thought go from the mind, and we just have the mind be pure awareness. But we couldn't meditate if we'd never heard the word meditation. Right? Or some kind of word for meditation. I mean, you can't explain what meditation is just by grunting. Yeah? You can try, but you're not going to get... So we use and words direct experience. They direct your attention. Yeah, by calling attention to something, right? Ah, look inwards. Yeah. Ah, if you look at the breath, contemplate the breath and see how the breath shapes your experience. Yeah. So by directing attention to these things, using words and concepts and so on, this is what in Buddhism they call nama-rupa, then that shapes the way that attention forms. It's a very powerful idea. For most of the time in Western philosophy, they usually had some kind of idea of the mind as being something like a tabula rasa. Right? The mind is a kind of a blank slate and you can kind of come and draw stuff on it. So it's an idea that the mind is kind of given. Right? The mind just exists, like a blackboard or a sheet of paper just exists, and we can come and put stuff in there. Yeah? But no, the Buddha said that these things evolve together. It's a much more organic way of seeing things. Yeah? The mind grows up organically in its context and in its environment, just like anything, just like a plant. Yeah, it's dependent on its soil and the water and so on, but it also influences those things. Yeah. Yeah, we know that now. Yeah, if you cut down all the trees, then the rain stops falling. Right, so it's not just a one-way conditionality; it's always a mutual conditionality. So when we understand this, one of the things that implies is that we have to take responsibility for our own mind. Yeah? How our mind is depends on how we use our mind. What do we do with it? How do we pay attention? What kinds of things are we going to use our mind for? What kinds of things are we going to stop using our mind for? Right? Things that might be painful or harmful. And when we direct our mind in that way, what kind of effect does it have? When we bring attention to these kinds of things, what kind of effect does that have? Yeah? So this is that process of inquiry, which we should all be kind of developing through our mindfulness and through reflection and through the meditation. Yeah? So be aware what happens when you have a very stressful day at work and people are yelling at you. Yeah, that's a certain kind of object of mind. There's these certain sounds. Yeah, it's a really good way to annoy people if they're angry with you. You say, oh, that's a sound. It's kind of passive aggressive Buddhism. Even worse is if you say to them, may you be happy. That's like So your mind is constantly being conditioned, yeah? And when you sit in meditation, that's what you're being aware of. When you bring your awareness to your breath, you bring awareness to what initially seems to be something that's separate from your mind, yeah? Awareness is somehow in here and you feel your breath is over there, and there's this kind of feeling that these things are separated. But the longer that you go on, the more that you see that everything that happens in your mind is somehow reflected in your breath. Yeah? Yeah? A memory comes up, oh, you feel angry because of what happened, and you see that in your breath, the tone of the breath changes. Yeah? Some thought about something else comes up, the tone of the breath changes. Your mind lets go and relaxes, the breath becomes more tranquil and your whole body becomes more tranquil. Everything that goes through your mind is constantly being reflected in your breath. This is how that breath meditation works. Yeah, it's not just watching air, it's watching part of you, part of your mind. And the longer you stay there, the more clear your awareness, the deeper and the more constant your mindfulness, the more you will see your own mind in that breath. And that's when you start to get the feelings of joy, the feelings of bliss and letting go, and the bright light, the nimitta that comes in the breath meditation. That bright light is nothing else than the reflection of your own mind, your own consciousness. That is the light of awareness, which becomes bright and becomes radiant when the defilements of the mind sink down and fade away. And the clarity and the mindfulness of the mind is very strong, and the mind becomes radiant. That's when you start to see this whole process in a much more direct way. Yeah? That's when you start to see not just a kind of a misty echo of the mind in all of these kinds of things, but you start to see the mind face to face, more looking directly at it. And realizing what awareness is. When you start to go to those deeper levels of meditation, deeper levels of awareness, it's a revelation. You realize that all of these things which we talk about, these ideas like peace and awakening and love and all of those things, you realize that they are all there inside you. And that by letting, and it feels like you're coming home, you let go all of these things. The more that you let go of everything that's disturbing your mind and disturbing your vision, the more it feels like, oh, this is just natural. This is just how things are. This is just like coming home. So this is my little talk for you this evening on meditation, the mind, conditionality of the mind. I offer that for your reflection, and I'd like to invite any comments or questions.